Canada is the world's leading mining nation.
60% of all public mining companies are listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange.
About half of all mining capital is raised in Canada.
Many Canadian mining companies have become notorious for damaging communities and the environment and fueling wars and repression all over the world.
They're displacing communities and killing people.
And they've left a legacy of mercury and lead contamination in that area that will never be cleaned up.
We use terms like genocide, ethnic cleansing.
We have a huge problem in terms of access to justice.
Just as European settlers created Canada by stealing and plundering native land, its mining companies today continue these practices all over the world.
This colonialism and neocolonialism is what Canada is all about.
You're listening to Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World, a three-part radio documentary. I am Asad Ismi.
And I'm Kristen Schwartz. This is Damaging Communities and the Environment, the opening episode in our series. For the next half hour, we focus on the drastic effect Canadian mining companies have had on Indigenous peoples in Canada and Papua New Guinea.
Canadian mining companies have been responsible for devastating communities and the environment all over the world, including in Guyana, Ghana, the Philippines, Papua New Guinea, Burma, India, Kyrgyzstan, Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, Ecuador, Peru, Romania, Spain, Chile, Argentina, Australia, the United States, and Canada.
In Guyana, the Canadian companies Cambior and Golden Star owned the Omai gold mine, which caused reportedly the biggest cyanide spill in world history in 1995, destroying the Essequibo River, Guyana's most important source of fresh water. The government declared a national emergency and more than 20,000 people lost access to food and water, with many suffering health problems. Canadian companies have also been responsible for the biggest environmental disaster in Ghana's history and 30 years of environmental destruction in the Philippines.
Indigenous communities have borne the brunt of mining operations worldwide. Canada itself was created by British and French settlers through the genocide of its indigenous people and the stealing of native land. Close to 15 million natives in North America were killed by European invaders, almost the entire population. There are 86 mining operations in Canada, and mining has devastated many communities all over the country, spreading death and disease by poisoning the air, water, soil, and food supplies through acid mine drainage, toxic effluents, and pollution. 10,000 abandoned mines endanger fragile ecosystems, while 50 lakes have been turned into dumps for mine waste.
The people of the Whitefish Lake First Nation are descendants of the Ojibwe, Algonquin, and Odawa nations. Their reserve is located near Sudbury, Ontario. The current land base is 44,000 acres, much of it forests. The total population is 850 members, with 340 living outside the reserve.
The Sudbury nickel and copper mines are the largest mining operation in Canada. The mines were opened in 1901. They were operated by Inco, a leading Canadian mining corporation, from 1916 to 2005. In 2006, Inco was sold to a Brazilian company and is now known as Vale Inco Limited. This documentary is concerned with Inco's record when it was a Canadian company for 89 years.
We spoke to Arthur Patatagoose during his tenure as the Whitefish Lakes First Nations Gima, or chief. According to him, the area of the Sudbury mines belonged to the nation and was stolen from it with the mine's creation. A treaty signed between the nation and the British Crown in 1850 set up the Whitefish Lake Reserve, which included Sudbury. However, the Crown and later the Government of Canada refused to survey the land in order to establish the boundaries of the reserve, even though the nation's representatives asked them to do this several times. The chief believes this to be an act of racism designed to deprive the Whitefish Lake First Nation of its land.
When nickel and copper were discovered at Sudbury and mines were set up between 1901 and 1908, the Canadian government stated that the mine areas were not part of the native reserve and therefore the state did not need the Whitefish Lake First Nation's permission to build them. Since the boundaries of the reserve had not been marked due to the government's refusal to survey the land, any part of the nation's land could be taken from it by Ottawa. In Chief Pedagogus's view, the Sudbury mines were created by deception and trickery through which the Canadian government stole the Whitefish Lake First Nations land from it.
We are bullied as a population. And I think about the child in the schoolyard where the bully comes in and takes his money. He pressures the individual to behave in a particular manner. That's how I've expressed our relationship in terms of how we sit with the Crown. The Crown bullies our people and is able to get away with it because we're not able to defend ourselves. So when we look at the territory of the First Nation, territory of Atikmekshing, the city of Sudbury is clearly within the boundaries of our territory. And that's partly what we're reminding Canada and Ontario about today, that this is something that's needed to be addressed. So that was part of this understanding of what was contained within the treaty agreement. However, what we see today is that the boundary that was put into place has been moved from where we had intended that it be originally placed. And this is part where we see the injustice on our part being suffered. The reserve has been made smaller, not by choice, but by design of the Crowns. We were removed by the Crowns so that the resources from the land would not have to be shared with us.
The nation has launched a $550 billion lawsuit against the Canadian federal government and the Ontario government on the basis that the area of the Sudbury mines belongs to the nation, as does the revenue generated by their operations for the past century.
The Canadian government's stealing of the Whitefish Lake First Nations land was not only an example of racism, but also part of the process of colonization, which was spearheaded by biological warfare. According to Chief Pattadagus, the white colonizers hoped to wipe out the nation totally through the spread of diseases such as smallpox and tuberculosis that they brought from Europe. 90% of the Whitefish Lake First Nation and other native communities were killed mainly by these diseases. There were tens of thousands of Whitefish Lake members in the Sudbury area. After the diseases killed so many, there were only tens left in Sudbury, and these natives were displaced by the mines. The mines thus completed the colonizing process of stealing native land, first implemented by killing the indigenous people, and then by displacing those left alive.
We were some of the first victims of germ warfare, and we say that's a tragedy. But the government doesn't talk about that kind of activity having occurred here in North America, because you don't want to talk about the nasty things that you do. Our numbers were decimated by the diseases, and our peoples, those that remained, the survivors, we had a difficult time in coming to reassert our presence. As a people, and we're still challenging. We're being challenged by this low point in terms of recovering from this kind of a tragedy. We hear about crimes against humanity type of concepts, and when we're a small population, we become victims, and we're not able to. Question. It's not well when that occurs to you. Those kinds of events occur. Our eventual extermination as a body of people. And that for us is a threat. And we're having to remind Canada that this is something that's occurring. And we use terms like genocide, the practice of what we saw over in Europe, ethnic cleansing. And we see this as being a policy which is being brought against us.
It was never an issue about power and fame, only pride and respect and family gain. No one's to blame for what occurred. In the 90s I look back and it seems absurd. We shared our knowledge and the gift of survival. We fought for our lands and it was called.
they perished. Land set aside, a reservation, let's talk straight. It's called a preservation to preserve and protect me. But the Anglo-Saxon people only reject me. Like an animal kept in a stall, the council shouldn't listen to the shaman's call.
Nor are the lives of the surviving members of the Whitefish Lake First Nation safe today. For 100 years and continuing, the Sudbury mines have poisoned their air, water, and soil, endangering, degrading, and shortening their existence. Acid rain and other pollution caused by the mineral industry have had a significant negative impact on the food supply of the nation. Fish is a major food source for the people, and they rely heavily on this. Acid rain has considerably damaged the fish stock, causing its quantity and quality to drop dramatically. This means that at times the nation has not had enough food, which has led to malnourishment and numerous deaths. Kathleen Nepance is Director of Community Health and Wellness at the Whitefish Lake First Nation.
We have had significant, I think, drop in fish. We do have a large number of people who fish and hunt still. Some of our community members here, still the wildlife is their main source of food. We have low-income families that still depend on the land to be able to provide their family with their proper food nutrition.
We look at the K1 species, they say the lake trout. We would see the adult fish, but we would not see the young. So that tells us something's happening with the eggs. And some of our work in talking with the research people, they've shared with us that the spaces where the fish would spawn, the adults would lay their eggs, those water bodies, the beds, were becoming contaminated with the acid rain particles, the outfall, the material that would be dumped from the stack.
We asked Chief Pradagus if this led to malnourishment due to lack of food.
In some of our earlier populations, yes. When we relied solely on the land, and this is in part for our my father's generation, my mother's generation, when they talk about the wage economy not being present, but they relied on the resources of the land to produce for them the foods that they were needing. So when there's less of a supply there, it meant that your children are going to have a less healthy diet. And in our case, in our particular family, disease came to us. We had tuberculosis, flus that have hurt our population. In some respects, I guess we could look at the mine as being in part responsible for that.
Other sources of food also damaged by pollution are animals, such as deer and moose, as well as trees. The animals have become sickly and their livers have been fouled. The leaves of maple trees have been burnt so that these no longer produce maple syrup, which the people used to collect. The nation sued INCO for the tree damage, and the company settled out of court.
We used to harvest the trees. We saw the value in selling the timber resources. But through time, the people noticed that when there was a reversal of the winds, when the sulfur fumes inundated our air, the day afterward we saw a decline in the trees. The leaves would turn yellow and they would drop off, which tells you that this is damaging the tree. In true time, we saw a population of the tree declining. Some of them would die. Some would recover, but a lot of them would die because they just couldn't sustain themselves because of the burn that resulted from the air fumes. So knowing that this was occurring, our people launched a suit against the company. And so there was a small compensation paid to us for some of the trees. But when you take a look at the quantity of work that was undertaken to produce the evidence which showed that, in fact, there was a direct resulting between the mine activity and the damage which was occurring, it was costly. We probably spent more money in studies than in compensation that was actually paid to the First Nation.
Members of the nation also suffer from high levels of asthma due to mine pollution. Sometimes the air is so bad that they cannot go outside. Pollution Watch Canada identified Inco as the biggest air polluter in Canada in 2003. In the same year, Environmental Defense Canada listed Inco as the worst mining polluter. The group's assessment is based on pollution data collected by the federal government.
And just recently there was a study initiated from the perspective of our community. What we've noticed is that there's been an increase in among our children, the aspect of asthma, the breathing problems. There's something going on here that's not right in terms of the wellness of people. Children should not be getting these kinds of more common occurrences. And the older people, their capacity to have a more healthy life is diminished, because you're breathing air that is not of a higher quality. And that's something that we readily notice, especially when there's a shift in wind from the northeast and the fumes are carried in our direction. People start to notice within a half an hour of time when that wind carries those fumes. It starts to affect your breathing. You can actually taste in your mouth, the chemical. So we become concerned that it's going to affect us in terms of our health.
A study of metals in Sudbury soils in 2001, conducted by the Ontario Ministry of the Environment, found that copper and nickel levels were above the recommended level in almost 80% of the samples, lead and selenium levels in a quarter of the samples exceeded guidelines, and 5% of the samples had above the recommended level for antimony, arsenic, cadmium, cobalt, and zinc. To make things worse, high concentrations of nickel, copper, cobalt, arsenic, lead, and zinc tended to turn up in the same samples.
Lead, arsenic, nickel, and cadmium have been declared legally toxic in Canada. Lead is associated with kidney and blood problems, as well as neurological disorders. Arsenic and nickel cause cancer and are believed not to have a safe threshold for human exposure. Cadmium is considered a probable carcinogen when inhaled and is associated with the development of kidney disease.
We do know that cancers have increased among our population. And when you go back and take a look at those toxic metals, the ones which are hazardous to us in terms of our health, we have to take a closer look at those elements and ask whether or not is that the cause of why we see things like higher incidences of asthma, diabetes, our people having problems with kidney damage as a result of diabetes. But is this element that's here in higher concentration a factor, the heavy metals attacking their kidneys? Our space that we're living in becomes much more of a hazard. And this is something that become very concerned about, contaminants that are within the soil, within the air. And this is partly, again, what we have been wanting to track as part of our concerns for the well-being of our people. That we know that cadmium is and that arsenic are very, very dangerous as elements. So we're going to be here. We're not going to go anywhere. Other people may be mobile and they will come to the city. They may leave to go to other parts of the world. But our people, we've always lived here and we intend to stay here. So the long-term impact of this accumulation of contaminant in and around our homes worries us.
The European invasion and the Sudbury mines have had a devastating effect on the Whitefish Lake First Nation.
So when you take a look at what has been brought to us by European settlers, they say, what has happened to you? You forgot your teaching. They say, what's happened to people that they forget about their sense of humanness? It's unfortunate that they have not learned more appropriate behavior, more moral behavior in terms of how to live.
Another Indigenous community drastically affected by Canadian mining are the Apili people of Papua New Guinea. Canada's Barrick Gold is the world's largest gold mining corporation. In Papua New Guinea, Barrick operates the Porgera gold mine, one of the world's biggest. The open-pit mine has transformed parts of this beautiful South Pacific island into a moonscape. Barrick has dumped tons of poison waste directly into rivers and streams. Mine debris and rivers full of mine tailings or waste are eroding the landscape and making hillsides collapse, thereby eradicating the homes of many villagers.
The Akali Thang Association is a human rights organization which addresses the rights abuses perpetrated by Barrick's Porgera mine security forces. According to the association, Porgera mine security guards have shot 33 people and raped 14 young girls. Also, the police have detained 2,000 people in lockups due to conflicts stemming from the mine. 20 more people have died as a result of waste dumped by the mine. Barrick admits to 9 killings.
In spite of its riches, the town of Porgera has no paved streets. Waste generated by the mine has ruined the land and livelihoods of 10,000 people. Barrick appears to be extracting as much gold as it can at minimum cost by impoverishing the community and severely degrading the environment. Barrick Gold is notorious for damaging communities and the environment and for violating human rights in several countries, including Tanzania, Australia, Argentina, Peru, Chile, the Philippines, the U.S., and Canada.
Jethro Tully is executive officer of the Akali Thang Association. He is a former labor leader who organized the first union at the Porgera mine. Tully and two other activists from Papua New Guinea traveled to Toronto in May 2008 to demand at Barrick Gold's annual general meeting that the company relocate the 10,000 people whose land has been destroyed by the mine. The company refused to do so. We spoke to Tully after a public meeting in Toronto.
They are horrible, they are terrible, they are criminals, corporate criminals. They are terrible companies, they should not be mining, I think. They should give up mining because they can't respect the nature, I mean, basic rules to do mining. They are causing destruction to everything.
There are 5 million people in Papua New Guinea. They belong to thousands of different indigenous groups that speak 800 languages. Tully is a member of the Apili ethnic group, the main one affected by the Porgera mine. The Apili are subsistence farmers and depend on the land. They grow sweet potatoes, taro, bananas, yam, and local vegetables.
We survive on the land. Now, most of the fertile land has been taken by the company. We were left to fend on a small portion. And now that is being overcrowded with the increase of population. And we cannot sustain ourselves. That's why we are saying, you are taking out more, so you have to relocate us. They have turned the society, the fabric of our society, upside down in space of just 20 years. We are becoming settlers in our own lands. Yeah. We can't live there. We are asking the company to relocate us.
Tully also wants Barrick to pay compensation for the people killed by mine security, as well as for environmental destruction.
We want them to pay for the damages on the debts, plus the damages to the environment, and relocate.
That's it.
End of story. What I have demanded from them to compensate us is roughly about $350 million. And that claim is still sitting with them.
The mine has dumped mountains of waste rock on Apili land, which has destroyed farming and houses and killed people, according to Tully. These mountains are called erodible dumps because they have been engineered to move like glaciers and deposit themselves in the river, a massively harmful process which will continue for 100 years after the mine has closed. Mark Ikepa is chairman of the Porgera Landowners Association.
When the dump gets bigger and heavy, it falls down. By landslip, yeah, it slips down into the river. Even the houses is covered up. School, houses, headpost and all this has been covered up by the dump. Six to 700 families living without house now. Almost 6 to 8 months.
So they're homeless?
They're homeless now.
People have been killed by the dumping, according to Jethro Tully.
They've disposed of the waste, which is caused landslips and landslides and causing harm to the local indigenous communities, which have in fact resulted in about more than 20 people dying in the dump areas by just burying them or by landslip burying them or floods carrying them away.
The Pogra mine deposits tailings straight into a nearby river rather than holding these in a tailings dam, which is usual practice. Such direct dumping into rivers is illegal in Canada due to the obvious health hazards. According to Tully, the dumping has poisoned the river.
I don't see any mine in the world that exposed life cyanide and life cyanide from the spread out from the mill into a big waterway.
The Apili people also rely on rainwater, which they collect from rooftops in tanks. Mark Ikepa describes how this rainwater has been contaminated by air pollution generated by the mine.
Because the air coming out from the sack mill, the mill itself, is some sort of a white smoke. And when it drops down to the plant's color changes into red. So even the rooftop of a building close to my house, where I live in, is all rusting up and getting red in color. So all the dust goes into the tank, which I drink it. No option to get water. Even the company doesn't provide the water supply, so I drink all these contaminated waters.
Jethro Tully's appeals for help to the Papua New Guinea government have brought no action due to the power Barrick Gold has over the state.
The government is corrupt. We do raise the matters that points are brought up, but nobody, the government can't say anything because probably they are, controlled by the companies.
The government has even refused to act on the 14 charges of rape brought against the mine's security personnel.
No action, no police. Police and company, they cooperate. The government cooperates. They cover up very quickly.
If Barrick does not pay compensation to the community, Tully is determined to resist its operations.
Either they stay or we stay, we will move them up. By force, we can move them up.
You have been listening to Damaging Communities and the Environment, the first episode of the documentary series, Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World.
Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World is dedicated to Indigenous peoples everywhere.
This documentary was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. Go to www.asadismi.ws. That's www.asadismi.ws to download the series.
Translation by Alex Petrov, Susie Alvarez, William Satcher, and Sandra Cuff. Voiceover by Matthew Fava and Susie Alvarez.
Theme music is Shaman's Call and Come Home Safe Dance Mix by TKO from Winnipeg, Canada. On this episode, you also heard Alir Pukai by the Alir Pukai String Band of Papua New Guinea.
Many thanks to Danae Baird and Kevin Shaw of CHRY 105.5 FM in Toronto.
This documentary was funded by the Canadian Union of Postal Workers National,
CUPW Local 576 North Bay,
Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 3903,
QP National,
Ontario Public Service Employees Union,
Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation,
Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association,
Public Service Alliance of Canada,
Ken Lucart,
and the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives.
Thank you for listening.